This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Welcome to the Rainbow Report. News, opinion, current affairs for the Rainbow community from Joy 94.9, Australia's only full-time gay and lesbian radio station. And now your host, Doug Pollard.
Well, good evening and welcome to the Rainbow Report. Tonight we're talking about violence, hatred and the anti-hate laws. Gays, lesbians and trans folk come under attack simply because of who they are, and there are many ways to tackle this. The Human Rights Commission has a new initiative. The Anti-Violence Project works on it continually, and there are laws meant to protect us from hate speech and crime. But do they work? Some people think they're a bad thing. Why should someone who assaulted one of us get a stiffer sentence because they were motivated by prejudice? Aren't anti-vilification laws an unfair restriction of free speech? We'd like to know what you think. 0427JOY949 is the SMS. Greg Adkins leads the Anti-Violence Project. How bad is the problem currently being experienced in Victoria, and what is the project doing about it? And what does violence do to us when we're the victim? How about when it's from one of our own or within a relationship? Psychologist Paul Martin of the Centre for Human Potential will guide us through. And I'll be asking Acting Victorian Human Rights Commissioner Karen Toohey about the anti-hate campaign they're currently running. Does this kind of campaign really help? It's called Anti-Hate Spray, and there's a website for it. And joining me in the studio is Joy's own newshound, Rod Swift. Good evening, Rod.
Good evening, Doug.
Now, have you ever been on the receiving end of hate, violence, etc., etc.?
I've been on the receiving end of some very, very interesting material that I received when I was heading up the Gay and Lesbian Equality Group in Western Australia, including basically vile scrawls of graffiti over print ads that we'd put in the newspaper, in the West Australian newspaper, and sent to our post office box, basically with death threats. And, for example, I know only recently during the Tasmanian debate, just spreading a bit further, that activists down in Tasmania and opponents as well got some nasty death threats and threats of violence. It's quite a disturbing trend.
Yeah, and especially when it gets into politics, that always makes me feel very uncomfortable. I mean, we've seen what's happening in Greece with the Golden Dawn movement,
for example. And you're only one step away once it gets into politics from being fanatical.
Ooh, we don't want to be fanatical. No, we don't want to be called fanatical. Well, have any of you been attacked verbally or physically? What happened? How did you deal with it? Do you think hate speech laws or hate crime laws, where you get a stiffer sentence for being, you know, doing a crime with a prejudicial motive, are they a good thing or do you see them as wrong? Are they criminalising thought, for example? Now, we're trying to get hold of Karen Toohey. She's the Acting Victorian Human Rights Commissioner. But unfortunately, she ain't answering her phone at the moment, which has left us hanging a little bit here.
Oh, a little bit tired.
Well, as I said, Karen Toohey is the Acting Commissioner of the Victorian Equal Opportunity and Human Rights Commission, and they recently launched an anti-hate webpage and campaign. I've put the link to it up on the show blog. It's called antihate.vic.gov.au, and it features a cute aerosol can of anti-hate spray. And, of course, it has lots of links to the commission, the police, some ready-written messages to use in response to abusive Facebook posts, etc. But I'm wondering if these things are actually effective. Rod, you've had a look at this, haven't you?
Yeah, I had a bit of an in-depth look at this one, and I posted my thoughts about it on some of the online websites and online chat via news groups. And look, one of the things I found that was really interesting about this new campaign is that it tries to encompass hate speeches on all different natures, whether it's on racial grounds, on sexuality, vilification based on religion, into basically almost a fun-to-use website. I know it sounds really weird, but if you go there, you'll see what I mean, listeners. And one of the things that was very, very interesting there is that it's actually not encouraging people who would be traditionally seen as the victims of such behaviour to stand up and say, you've got your rights at law, which a lot of anti-discrimination equal opportunity laws or campaigns have done in the past, saying, if you are a victim, report it. If you are a victim, and I love that word victim because it makes us victims, report it to the commission, you know, take action, you know, go to tribunals. This is a different campaign. In fact, it encourages people who aren't in the particular minority groups concerned to actually stand up and say, I don't like the behaviour I've just observed from one of my friends. And there's actually emails you can send to your friends saying, you know what, that Facebook post I just saw of yours was racist. And it says, you know, I didn't appreciate it. And that is actually changing the game, I think, with this particular campaign. And it would be great to talk to Karen about it in a second, because it's actually asking average people...
If she ever answers that phone.
The average person, the majority out there, to take action and draw that line in the sand that we as a community draw in the line and are asked to draw in the line in the sand out of discrimination. It's asking everyone to adopt the same moral ground, that moral viewpoint of saying enough is enough. And I think it's a great campaign for that reason alone.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of cute.
It's cutesy.
It's a lot less heavy, as you say, than the usual kind of thing. Is it aiming at a younger kind of market? Is it trying to get younger people to take an interest in this? Because traditionally, the kind of people who fire up and send off letters and so on is people like you and me, who do it anyway as a matter of course, people who've been doing it for years.
I think it actually is in enacting a particular subsection of the community. I think you're right, Doug. It is activating people aged, I'd say, between around about 14. So we're talking about teens who are getting into the awareness of that they see bullying at school, 12, 13, 14 onwards. So we're talking about high school students, up to people probably in the peer group of maybe 35 or 40, and are people who are already our allies, but they don't feel that they have a right to speak up. And I think it's empowering them to turn around to people when they see an act in the street where they think it's wrong, to turn around and say, and go up to people and say, that was wrong. And if that means that we've got more little moral police out there that happen to be on our side, that's a good thing. Because if we take the opposite of that, Doug, if we take the vacuum that is created when people don't point things out and call it out and call it for what they see it, and I know I blogged on The Stirrer recently about this and calling hate what it is, call hate hate, don't call it homophobia, call it what it is. If we don't encourage people who are just average, everyday people to draw that line in the sand, then we're left with this vacuum where that behaviour is tolerated, is the blind eye turned to, the way it used to work.
Yeah. Is this not also aimed very much at the Facebook generation? It's aimed at Facebook, it's aimed at Twitter, it's aimed at cyberbullying and things like that.
Absolutely.
Because that's why you've got these sort of... you've got pre-written tweets, you've got pre-written Facebook posts, you've got pre-written emails and so on that you can use.
And look, it levers off of that too, because as we all know,
because people don't often really know how to respond to a tweet or a Facebook page. They're not sure whether it's wrong or not. They're not sure, because it's coming from a friend, exactly how they should phrase it.
Yeah, but equally, though, as we all know with any social media, it is so reactive nowadays. That's why we've had the Twitter troll issues, where people will fire off something so quickly. And there are people now turning around and saying, I should be challenging material I read from my friends, just like I'd say, hey, that was uncalled for if you were in person with them. Why should they have an outlet of hate on the cyberspace, if you wouldn't allow that at a social event, a workplace, anywhere else? I think that it allows those people who are social media savvy to turn around and say, you know what? I want a social media space where I can go to, and I expect to have a fair space which I see in everyday life. I expect to have the same sort of treatment online, and that people shouldn't be bullied just because it's a faceless medium.
Well, James has raised an interesting point. He says, surely we're better off empowering people to stand against hatred and make it socially unacceptable rather than reinforcing the belief that we as a minority are somehow weaker and we need special protection and special laws and special whatever to keep us safe.
And look, I'm going to use another word I love to use, Doug, and I know you're going to probably give me heaps of brandy points for this one too. I hate the word victim. I don't think we should be victims. I also don't think we should be token. And I can tell you right now, if you rewind the clock 30 years for women, women didn't want to be treated as token individuals and given token human rights to be given equality. They want to be treated equally socially and included. And same with people on the basis of race and on religion. Why aren't we demanding inclusion, which we have for many, many years, but demanding it from our friends to say, I not only deserve to be included, you should be saying that person, me, my friends who are gay, lesbian, bi, should be included too.
And this is Doug Pollard bringing it to you. Now, we're still trying to get hold of both Greg Adkins and Karen Toohey. So in the meantime, we're going to my next guest, who is Paul Martin. He's a psychologist in Queensland. He's an ex-gay, if I can put it that way. He now works with people in the gay community to help them get over their traumas, and especially when they've been subjected to violence. And what we particularly wanted to talk to him about, actually, was domestic violence within the gay community. But we'll get on to other topics as well. Good evening, Paul, and thanks for joining us.
Good evening, Doug. My pleasure.
Now, we were, as I say, hoping to talk about anti-violence generally, but we're having a little trouble guest-wise, so thank you for coming on early.
My pleasure.
I do love to be rescued, the white knight as it is.
That's right, exactly.
Now, you're an experienced counsellor dealing with the aftermath of violence. But before we get onto the domestic violence thing, I just wanted to ask you about the aftermath of violence for people who are subjected to anti-gay violence of one kind or another. What does that do to people? What does it do to their self-esteem, for example?
It's particularly nasty, and the reason I say that is because it often starts in childhood with bullying in the schoolyard, one of the big problems with, and even in adulthood, one of the huge problems is particularly if someone isn't out and they have been bullied or they've had some violence perpetrated against them because they're gay or they're perceived to be gay, and because people often feel a sense of shame about their orientation, they're less likely to report it, to do something about it, and to gain access to services such as a shelter or counselling. There's also fears of how the police would respond to them, even if they are out. We've got a long history in our culture, in our country, of the law being incredibly unhelpful until recently. It wasn't that long ago that it was a crime to be doing anything that's to do with same-sex sexual activity. So there are many layers to it. So violence based on someone's sexuality, or the other problem is that it really perpetuates and deepens the sense of being disordered or sinful or bad or somehow wrong or disordered. So that's one of the other things, is it actually reinforces those things and gives people a sense of power.
Okay, now, we've been talking earlier on about anti-vilification laws and anti-hate crime laws. These are not really very much helping these sort of situations, are they?
Well, not really. I mean, I think what they do is send out a strong message to the community that the law is actually demonstrating some degree of prioritising this as an issue, which is fantastic. But in terms of it actually having an impact, positive impact on the ground, is questionable.
Because as I understand it, there have been very few successful prosecutions anyway using the vilification laws or using the hate crime laws.
Yes, and one of the other problems with the system as it is, with our justice system, is that people often get put through the mill and they actually become re-traumatized. So the actual process of it's a bit like going for a work cover claim.
So this is a bit like being a rape victim or something like that. You go through it twice.
Yes, that's right, exactly. So you actually go through the violence once, you start to recover from that, and then you have to go through a number of different assessment processes, such as a psychiatrist, psychologist, talk to your lawyer. So every time you're talking about it, you're going through it again. And it's not done in a therapeutic way, which means that, if you've been a victim of violence and you're really struggling, most people survive well, but for those who don't, counselling is good. And it does involve talking about it, but it's in a very safe space.
Okay, Rod Swift, you wanted to come in here.
Yeah, hi, Paul. Look, I've got a quick question. We were talking just before you came on about the fact that some of the campaigns now, especially one down here in Victoria, are trying to change the culture to include our allies into identifying difficulties of behaviour, whether it's in the online space or in the real world, and turn around and actually identifying that. Despite all the laws you could have in the world, you know, against vilification and against violence, isn't cultural change one of the biggest ways of trying to minimise some of the effects of this sort of toxic world we've lived in the past?
Yeah, cultural change is an ideal thing to aim for. I think it's a really important point you're making. The only downside to that is the time it takes to actually modify culture. Because quite often what happens...
what you're saying is it's easier to modify a law than it is to modify an attitude, but surely the laws, when you change the laws and you put up these special protections for us and that, you're actually inviting an equal and opposite reaction from the other side. You're actually making things worse.
That may be the case. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen any research that would indicate that, but certainly, for example, in terms of changing attitudes, if you look at an organisation that implements HR diversity policies,
Sorry, I haven't gone anywhere.
No, that's all right. I was just saying that, say, for example, in a company that has diversity policies and training, that might start to shift behaviours a little bit, but it doesn't shift attitudes. They often take decades and generations to change.
So what does shift attitudes?
What shifts attitudes is when people become emotionally engaged in a particular issue with whatever.
Okay, so let me stop you there for a second. So that immediately says to me two things might work really well here. One is if they actually know somebody gay.
Absolutely.
If people, you know, I've always said the best thing you can do for your fellow gays is to come out. I don't think there's any excuse not to. And I think that's really important. We've showed it with the way we've changed the behaviour of MPs and things by actually going and talking to them. And the other thing is cultural. It's TV shows. Yep. It's things like Modern Family and Will and Grace and all those sort of things, yes, where you change the cultural attitudes.
Yes, absolutely. Look, I think that those television shows are fantastic because people, it sort of demystifies gay and lesbian people. As you say, coming out is essential for, I mean, some people might not feel safe doing so, but it is such an important thing to do. And it is when someone actually kind of emotionally connects to whatever the issue is, and that shifts their attitude.
Actually, Paul, I've got another thing that I'd like to bring up and bring you back to the point. And I think you actually identified a really good point when you talked about HR policies in companies. I know that a number of companies I've worked for have had the wonderful platitudes about, you know, everyone's included. But it's like a wallpaper effect in certain areas of that company, especially large multinationals. And I work for one which is particularly blue collar. While they have a great diversity policy... let's face it, it's like a piece of wallpaper over a very large crack in the wall because no one's actually living or embracing or breathing into that culture. It's just almost, and I'll use the word I used earlier, a tokenistic gesture.
Absolutely. It's absolutely imperative. Like, for example, even safety. People might get a whole lot of training on safety, but unless they emotionally engage with why they should be safe in the workplace, they're not going to change their behaviours.
That's right.
And as you said, even diversity training can sometimes, if not done well, actually exaggerate the differences that people see in each other and cause people to fragment.
Yeah. It's a very fraught area.
Joy 94.9 is a GLB TIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
And this is Doug Pollard bringing it to you with the able and very professional assistance of Rod Swift and also TJ working like a demon on the phones there. We have finally managed to get hold of Greg Adkins. He's a mainstay of Joy, of course, Rainbow Labour, too many other community groups to mention, but principally he's the chief executive of the Anti-Violence Project. And guess what? They have a nifty website as well, antiviolence.info, with all the links you could ever need for reporting attacks, etc., etc. And he joins us on the line now. Good evening, Greg.
Good evening, Doug. And it's been a great listen to this show so far.
Touch wood, as I say. Skating by the seat of our pants today, but never mind. Now, just give us a little bit about the Anti-Violence Project for a start. How long has it been running?
Well, we're in our 16th year, Doug. Actually, January 20th will be the end of our 16th and start of the 17th year. Yeah. So it's been running for quite a while.
It has indeed. What's the biggest problem you have to deal with? Is it getting government to listen to you? Is it, you know, what's the biggest challenge you've got?
I actually think government listens to us. I think we've got the ears of both state and federal governments and perhaps political parties of all persuasions. The dilemma is the resources. I mean, we're homophobia, prejudice, violence, crime against us and within our community falls at the bottom end of people's importance scale. And big campaigns like No to Homophobia have raised that importance, one would hope.
Yeah.
And until we, as other people have been discussing, until we get societal change, it won't move our needs further up the totem pole to where they actually get addressed immediately.
Well, I just want to read you a story that's been sent in by one of the listeners, and it's quite disturbing, really. This is from Jack. She says, "Hey, Doug, I get attacked at work occasionally. I drive late buses in the fringe suburbs around Melbourne. 99% of these attacks have been by white men 15 to 40, usually drug or drink affected. I've not been actually physically attacked, but I've been spat on 3 times. I've had the protective screen that partially surrounds me punched several times, and I've been verbally attacked countless times." Then she goes on to say, "The attacks have got a bit less since I've grown my hair longer and don't wear a traditional dyke spike anymore. What happens to me parallels what happens to Indian and Asian drivers, and the attacks also happen to straight women drivers." That's pretty horrible.
It's prejudice crime, Doug. It's violence based on a person's attribute, and it's where we stand equal, gay, lesbian, trans, anyone that's being victimised for our sexuality or our gender. We stand equal to the Indians, people of cultural or faith backgrounds that are all being or receiving prejudice based on one or more attributes that they possess.
But do we need specific laws that criminalise these assaults on the basis of the motivation? I mean, surely an attack's an attack.
Well, we do in Victoria. We actually have provisions on in the Sentencing Act here in Victoria, which means anyone that causes crime or does harm to another person and goes in front of the courts, their penalty risks being increased because it was based on their faith, their gender, their sexuality, or their cultural background.
But do you think that's right? I mean, the crime's a crime's a crime. Why should the motive have any effect on the sentence?
Because how do you change society, Doug, if you don't provide penalties where people are being victimised or vilified just on the basis of who they are?
Well, you know, I actually disagree with you on this one, Greg. I really think these laws are possibly even counterproductive.
I'm going to jump in. I sat in Sunshine Court not long back where 4 men were in court. 3 actually turned up, another one bailed and just refused to come, disappeared, and they actually had to arrest him in his home some months later. He actually subsequently went to jail for a prejudice crime against lesbians that he'd committed. And I sat in court and watched these people. I think for some people in society, that is the only message that will get through their prejudice and make them see the different pathway to go down.
Rod Swift.
I'm going to sort of agree with you both. And I know that means I'm going to have either splinters in my backside from sitting on the fence, but I can speak from both perspectives, and I want to put it in context here. In Victoria in recent years, of course, we've had some very, very terrible incidents, including, for example, the attack on the Indian student in Garg where he died, and that was motivated by, and it comes down to motive, motivated by a racial targeting and an attack. When there's motive, I think penalties being assessed by a judge, and that's the way it should be done in sentencing, to say if you had motive that you attacked this person on the basis of a particular reason, then yes, I would agree that they possibly deserve, in the purview of the judge's sentencing and weighing up of all the factors involved with the accused person being convicted, should be able to make a sentence that warrants all of the circumstance of that crime. I don't think that necessarily needs special laws, and this is where I might agree with Doug here, to say that it should be a factor considered especially in that sentencing. It should just be considered as part of every part of that sentencing, as a judge would normally. But, for example, I will now flip to the other side of the coin. I am a victim of crime. I was attacked in 2000, in fact, on Christmas night in 2000, stabbed by 2 people who tried to rob me. I'm a gay man. Should they automatically be subjected, just because I might stand up and claim I happen to be gay? There was clearly no motive in their attack. Their motive was money, not my sexuality.
Rod,
and that's where it comes down to motive. And I think that judges, and this is where I'll agree with Doug, already have the purview of the whole facts of a case and should be able to make a sentencing decision based on that.
Yeah, and you can't prove a motive. A motive is a thought. A motive is an emotion. You can infer one.
I'll give you a motive. A young man we had walking across from Elmer Park, through Elmer Park to get cigarettes at the service station on Dandenong Road. A gay man walking through what's known as a beast, but he was just walking from his residence there. And a group of four men with box cutters, torches and their arms had been beating the crap and scaring the crap out of gay men, threatening to rob them for a number of weeks. And no one had stepped up and said, hang on, this is happening. Get the police down there. No one had talked about it. This young man, for the price of having his wallet robbed, ended up being opened up with a box cutter because of the prejudice that these men had against gay men, believing that gay men would never talk about what happened to them, would never disclose to the police. In fact, the police wouldn't assist them. That's the issue we have.
Yeah, but equally, Greg, and as I said, I agree with both sides of the point here. Equally, and that is a horrific and terrible crime. Certainly, they might not have used the particular implements they did to attack this person if they didn't know that he was gay. But equally, shouldn't a judge understand and in the purview of sentencing, understand all those factors and be able to still, for example, issue a sentence at the higher end of the scale of sentencing options?
Yeah, great point, Rod. And the difficulty is, it never gets to the judge. Only 9 out of 10 don't report if they're in rural regional centres, or 7 out of 10 don't report if they're in city areas. It's never getting to the point where even police find about it, and it never gets to the judge because we underreport violence against us.
And then, Greg, that actually then leads to a different issue which is not even dealt with by laws to deal with, extra penalties for people who attack on the base of a particular attribute, and that is... And we've talked about this all night tonight. Isn't it then a cultural problem that people are so fearful of reporting that is the underlying block to some of these things happening, especially, for example, in rural areas? I can't see how a law which may impose greater penalties based on, an attribute used in an attack would help anyone in a rural area be more likely to report. I think that having a police culture and a justice culture would be a much more handy tool in encouraging people to report such violence.
Well, Paul Martin earlier said that he talked about allies and for people to step up in cultural change. If the allies in a small country town are the ones that pick up your battered bones in the gutter and go to the police and tell them the car, the size of the people that bashed the man that they're presenting to the hospital, if the allies, straight allies, come and partner in this effort to try and eliminate homophobia and violence attached to it, then we win. We achieve cultural change. We shift. And that, I actually believe we actually have to have cultural change right across the community, where it doesn't matter if you're gay or straight. If you see something happen against a poof or a dyke, you're going to be stepping up and making sure it doesn't happen to anyone else.
Well, we've got Paul Martin, I think, still with us on the line. Paul, do you want to come in here?
Yeah, sure. Look, I've actually worked with prisoners in maximum security prison in Pentridge many years ago, and look, certainly I do understand the mentality of a lot of these people. And look, one of the things is that sometimes they do only listen to a very blunt instrument, which is that it's not okay, and there is a specific kind of criminal code or whatever the hell they would think about it that says you can't, it's not okay to bash a gay or a lesbian. And the other thing is, it comes off the back of a culture where we had the gay panic defence, which is still here in Queensland, which gave the opposite impression. So there is a legacy there which is still around, I think, because it was only so recent that it has been overturned. That psychologically for people, that they were thinking that the law was actually condoning violence against gay and lesbian. So it almost needs a bit of a pendulum swing the other way to make a big difference.
Yeah, I just want to bring in here a message from a listener here saying, if people aren't reporting crimes, then what good are these laws that... add this additional penalty because it was motivated by prejudice. It's not helping.
Well, I think one of the things that I think is that when gay and lesbians feel that they are specifically protected by the words in the law and it has LGBTI stuff in it, that it actually would provide them with a sense of safety around being able to report violence. So I think it would be quite, it sends out a very strong message to both sides, that on the one side,
Look, you can overcome your shame about being gay. It is safe to be able to speak to the police, and your issues, about violence, will be taken seriously, because a lot of people don't have evidence to suggest that that's the case. In fact, they have evidence that that's the opposite.
I think Paul's smack on the money there, Paul. Thanks for saying that. The retired Justice Geoffrey Eames did a huge report here in Victoria on prejudice motivated crime that sat on the table under this current Liberal government and hasn't seen the light of day. And that report will show where action needs to take place in any government department right across our society. And it is probably the portent to the work that needs to be done to fund organisations like the Anti-Violence Project and have this discussion in community. So maybe that's a challenge for you, Doug, and your listeners to get out there and lobby the government to release Justice Eames' report.
Yeah. As I say, I'm uneasy about these laws for a number of reasons. I mean, we're always banging on about wanting to be treated equally. We want equality. We want to be treated the same as everybody else, whereas these laws seem to be singling out people like us, people of different races, people of different religious beliefs, and saying that we somehow need to be given special rights over and above everybody else. And that kind of like feeds into what you hear back from, you know, the extreme right wing, who come back and say, well, what about white rights, for example, if you want to take a really extreme example. And I also have a distaste, if you like, for lumping an extra sentence on someone because of their prejudices. It strikes me as being part of what I would call a revenge agenda. It's a bit like the whole thing of, you know, you're not trying to rehabilitate this person, you're just clobbering them harder.
Well, Doug, 70% of homophobic vilification using language will escalate to physical violence. We're not talking about tapping people on the shoulders, we're talking about gross physical violence against the individual. We're talking the high end of violence that comes from homophobia. You don't hand to that by a powder puff in the courtroom annex. Now, you've got to have hard laws that are equally in our society adopted by the whole society against people who are trying to kill us, Doug.
Yeah, but I mean, those same laws should be the same against anybody trying to kill anybody else.
And
why?
They are, when it's based on prejudice, on faith, on sexuality, on race, or on gender, they're equal. So we're not special laws for the gays. It doesn't work that way. It's anyone where in society where prejudice forms the reason why you've been violated, you suddenly have the protection of these laws.
Yeah, well, that brings me to a case I was reading up about, which I found a little bit kind of disturbing. There was a case in Sydney where a man set fire to the guy's unit he was living next door to because he thought the guy was a pedophile. Now, the guy wasn't a pedophile, but the arsonist really hated pedophiles, so he set fire to this unit next door. Now, when this case came up for sentencing in the courts in Sydney,
did that mitigate?
The judge added an extra penalty because the crime was motivated by hatred. In this case, hatred of pedophiles, even though the guy concerned wasn't a pedophile. So isn't there a danger that you start kind of, you know, piling this extra thing on for almost any characteristic, even one that society isn't very fond of?
Do you think those perpetrators will think twice the next time?
Well, I doubt there'll be a next time.
isn't that the issue? Aren't we trying to rehabilitate people? And if they've grown up in the greater urban areas of Melbourne or Sydney or wherever and they haven't got a clue about gender or sexuality difference, something's going to have to change them, or else they're going to be carrying out these acts all the way through their lives.
And one of the other things that I think research demonstrates is the much greater levels of physical and other forms of violence towards LGBTI communities. And when you look at the types of crimes against transgender women in particular,
yeah,
a lot of those crimes are so disgusting, like they will leave a body, you can't even recognise the body. It seems to have a bizarre edge to it. So from there are a few different levels here. One of them, I think, is that, you know, if we had the same amount of violence perpetrated against our communities as straight communities, it might be a different story. But unfortunately, the statistics are very clear, and there's been some recent evidence come out to support this, that we as communities do experience hugely elevated levels of violence.
So you're saying that because there is a specific special problem relating to our community, that it needs a specific law to tackle it?
I'm not an expert in the law area, but that intuitively from a psychological perspective, I think makes a lot of sense in terms of the message, again, I think that sends out to the people that would tend to be perpetrators.
Rod.
Yeah, I want to come back to a point that Paul made earlier, and it's a very important point. The homosexual advance defence sends in law where it still exists, and I know Queensland, of course, has this difficulty right now, that there's a mitigating circumstance that you can basically use a reasonable level of force to resist an advance from someone, that it condones a certain level of violence. You're absolutely right in that regard, Paul. Now, I know when I was in Western Australia and we reformed the laws there, that the homosexual advance defence was also part of Western Australian law. That was dealt with and removed from the book, so it couldn't be a mitigating circumstance in all sorts of crimes. And that was done also by educating the judiciary about the need to take, again, all facets of a case when sentencing. Do you think there is a point in the future where we can trust, and we should entrust, I think, our judiciary, to get the sentencing right, that they can weigh up all the elements of a case, including targeting and specific motivations based on gender, sexual orientation, race, whatever, that we won't need these laws?
I mean, from what I've seen so far, the sort of profiles that we see of judges sometimes mean that they do have a bit of an unconscious bias, and I'm not suggesting that they aren't... It's just that they're not 100% objective, and nor could they be, I guess.
I don't think anybody ever can be, Paul.
No, I think you're right. And because we're all brought up from very, very young age hearing homophobic messages the whole time, judges would still unconsciously have a lot of those filters within them. So I would love to see the day where we're all treated equally, that judges do take into account all of the different... complexities, but I'm not sure that actually does happen in all cases.
Okay, thanks for that, Paul. Paul, can you stay on the line, because I want to talk to you about the domestic violence angle in a moment.
Sure.
Greg, thank you very much for your time tonight. Interesting discussion. We'll look forward to trying to get Winkle this report out of the government, as someone said. Oh, there goes Adkins being part of that again.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks, Rod.
Thanks, Greg.
Now, I've had a few messages in here, and some also I got before the show, because I was asking people to tell me about their experiences. There's one here. It's difficult to successfully prove beyond reasonable doubt a cognitive belief and emotion like hate. I'm not denying that serious crimes against GLBTIQ people occur. I merely say that hate should not be a word that's used lightly. Whilst it may have been a factor in some physical attacks, it doesn't mean it's so in other cases, particularly when we're talking about speech, when we're talking about phrases like, that's so gay. Okay.
My skin's crawling now.
That's an interesting one there. Now, this also, consider yourself lucky if you've not had any gay-hating thugs acting cowardly in a group try to kill you. I have, and sadly many of us have been on the receiving end of this kind of hate crimes. This is important work, and I take my hat off to you, Doug, for initiating this. It is a serious problem, and one we don't talk about very much. The other thing we don't talk about very much, as I said before, is domestic violence, that is, violence within our own relationships. And that's why I've asked Paul Martin to stay on the line, because, Paul, are we more likely to indulge in domestic violence in our relationships than straight couples?
I'm not sure that we're more likely, but it does happen a lot more frequently than most people would imagine. I just saw some research. The statistics are very hard to come by because often they are based on self-report, so it's probably inherently inaccurate. But just some stats that I saw recently from the United States saying that approximately between 22 to 46% of lesbians in intimate partner relationships have been involved with physical violence, and 15 to 20% of gay men have been affected by domestic violence. So, the statistics are much higher than people would imagine, unfortunately.
Do you think this is due to the fact that holding a relationship together, a same-sex relationship together, in the face of societal disapproval is inherently more difficult, especially when we don't have, although we're beginning to have now, legal forms of recognition for those ties?
I think it's a wonderful question because certainly it demonstrates the inherent complexity of this issue.
And one of the problems is that with heterosexual relationships, there's a lot of glue binding them together. And so when there are issues, you know, it's really quite natural for either partner to speak to their mum or dad or their brother or their mates from work or whatever and be able to get it out and do something about it. With a lot of gay lesbians...
it's a sort of it's more of a pressure cooker, you're saying, you know, with a same-sex relationship.
Absolutely. It's very difficult to talk to people about domestic violence issues for a whole range of reasons. One of them is shame about it as well. Some people most people think that gay and lesbian relationships are no good. If I talk about it to my mum, it'll prove to her that being gay is disordered. Or if I talk about it to my mates, it'll be...
Told you so. Yeah, I get that. Rod?
Yeah, Paul, I wanted to ask a two-pronged sort of question. I think you've sort of answered the first one. Do you think that there is, and I won't say there's a greater rate of domestic violence in GLBTI relationships, I think it's about the same as any other relationship, but do you think that there is a less likely chance that people report it because of, again, that ingrained culture, the years and years and years of being on the receiving end of possibly poor treatment in society, that people put up with more and therefore they don't escape or challenge difficult domestic relationships? And secondly, do you think there might be some, you know, theory or suggestion that, again, because of that cultural background of GLBTI people copying such a raw deal in the past, and I hate to use this term, but is there possibly a theme of the victims becoming the perpetrators?
Look, those two questions are amazing. So perhaps just a little bit of the last one. Mm. Because a lot of gay and lesbian people growing up have been subject to bullying, what happens is that you develop this very deeply held belief that that's what life's about. And what that means is that sometimes it means that you enter into abusive relationships without knowing it. And the other thing is that when it happens, you don't tend to have big alerts inside of you thinking, oh, my God, this is terrible. You think, this is what the way life is. I've just got to put up with it.
So you think you've normalized it within your own head?
Yeah, that's right, at a very deep unconscious level, because that's the template which says to you, that's the way life is.
So it's no different, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. Now, the first question, because the second one was excellent, I just want to make sure I've got the first one clear, and there was something about actually accessing services and if you have been a victim. Was that correct?
Yeah, Paul, the question was, and it sort of bounced off the answer you just gave there, that if there is this sort of ingrained subconscious or learned behaviour that, you know, life is rough for me, take that particular mindset, that there is a greater propensity to make domestic violence incur for longer periods of time or to greater extents than other relationships, because you have to get to a greater breaking point, a point where the straw that breaks the camel's back is just so much further on because of that underlying culture you've always been exposed to.
Spot on. You summarised it beautifully. You could do a thesis based on what you just said.
Thanks.
And the other thing is people's experience of accessing services. I know a great lesbian psychologist here in Queensland who did some research that indicated that 50% of lesbian women accessing mainstream psychological and physical health services had a very negative experience based on a number of different things, such as their sexuality. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people won't actually disclose their sexuality. And GPs are sometimes and quite often the first port of call. Now, if you don't believe or trust that GP is going to, really affirm or, in a way, validate your experience, and particularly if you're a guy, you know, and as a man as well, going to a doctor, there's a sense of shame. You know, men, obviously they fear that the doctor will be homophobic, and secondly, that there is this great sense of shame as a male survivor or a male victim. It goes against everything we've been taught from a kid about what it means to be a guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, look, thank you very much for stepping into the breach tonight, Paul.
My pleasure.
It's been lovely to have you along.
Yeah.
And we'll obviously this is a subject we shall need to come back to in the future. But for the time being, thanks for your time tonight.
My pleasure. No worries. Thank you.
Now, I have a story here I want to tell you because it was a story that was sent to me earlier on today. And I think it's important. It's a little bit on the long side. Bear with me. But this is the kind of thing we've been talking about tonight. This is from Phil. He says, Things have generally improved over the decades, but anti-gay verbal abuse and physical violence is still a problem at times for us. There have been murders of people just because they are or are thought to be gay. There have been many serious assaults on gays for the same reason. To bash someone unconscious while screaming faggot, and for the assailant to work themselves into a fury as they deliver vicious kicks to the head, that is nothing short of a hate crime. Now, like a good number of gays, I have been on the receiving end of this kind of gay hate. When leaving a gay dance in a country area, I had five thugs in a car call me Pufta before rapidly accelerating and driving into me. I flew through the air and landed on the roadway, sustaining back and arm injuries which required hospital treatment. The assailants rapidly sped off and have still not been identified. For all they knew, I could have landed on my head and been lying unconscious in the roadway waiting to die. I later learned from the police there had been numerous attacks on gays leaving the same community hall after gay dances. The thugs appeared to be quite happy with violently assaulting gays, including striking people over the head with blocks of 4x2 timber, all the while yelling faggot, pufta, etc. On top of this, I've also seen anti-gay violence as a health professional. I've seen people assaulted in gay bashings. I've seen one gay murder as a result of blows to the head. I've seen a young man with permanent brain damage from his gay bashing. Another whose brain damage was so bad he required institutional care for the rest of his life. Make no mistake, there are people in society who are happy to see us die, and some of them are happy to take the action required to kill us just because of our sexuality. This is motivated by nothing short of hate, and never forget it. To ignore this sad reality is dangerous and foolish. And I want to thank Phil for sharing that story with us.
Thanks, Phil.
This is the kind of thing we're talking about when we say that perhaps we do need a more serious sentence for people who carry out those sort of crimes because of hate. In fact, Craig has just messaged in to say that. Rod?
Look, I think that this topic could go for another show, Doug, and I tell you, I think we should revisit this, because one of the other things I've also noticed in my many, many years just around the traps is that, and I want to come back to the thing I talked with about Paul, the victims becoming perpetrators. I can name scores of examples where I've seen people who've been the subject of a poor outcome and bullying going on to be bullies and ostracising people within our community, to treat people just so poorly and terribly, almost like bitchy mean girls. I think that some people in our community need to take a long, hard look at themselves and actually work out if we need to have a conversation about civility. I think we need to look at ourselves sometimes too.
I think we do, and that's a topic for another show.
Absolutely.
Because we've got, like, you know, race hatred within our own community and so on and
oh,
so
yes.
forth. Quick message here from John. He says, you want safety? Get a carry permit and a revolver.
I've got one of those. No.
there is actually a group in the US that does exactly that. They call themselves the Pink Pistols.
Well, okay. Lock and load, Doug.
Yeah, lock and load. Okay, my name's Doug Pollard.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.